think it was Benjamin Franklin who said that there's two things in this world that are certain, death and taxes. Death and taxes. It strikes me that we try to minimise both. So if you ask John or Coralie, good tax accountants, they will point you to tax minimisation schemes, legitimate ones. You can do that. Death is harder to minimise, isn't it? But people still come up with all kinds of ways to try and put it off. So there's the gym. There's the personal trainer. There's the detox diets. There's the Botox. There's the plastic surgery. And it's all about pushing back the end point of your body's deterioration. Even the names we use around death, I mean, we don't call it death anymore. We call it passing away. We call it resting in peace. Hundreds of years ago, when you came to church, because that's what people did back then, you would walk through a graveyard to get into the building. The graves of people from your family, from your community, and I think it was intentional, because it's saying, this is certain. That's why you need what's going on inside there. But we've moved cemeteries out of our towns. We don't even have them. We cremate people nowadays. And all of it is about lessening the visible footprint of death. It's out of sight. It's out of mind. Of course, until something like the coronavirus pops up, and while I've heard it termed as a fairly civil kind of virus, it freaks us right out. It spooks us. Because we think, what if it's worse than this? And as infectious and as spreading as rapidly. It's putting its bony, grim, reapery fingers on our fears. Fears that we often try to ignore, certainties that we put off dealing with. I was reading during the week about a famous author by the name of William Saroyan. He was dying of terminal cancer, and he was interviewed on the phone just before he died. And he said, everyone has to die, but I always believed an exception would be made in my case. Now what? Now what? And he hung up the phone. He'd been ignoring it, not believing it was something to deal with, not something to face up to, and now what? Now what? If it's unavoidable and there's no exceptions, how do you face death well? Now I want to put it to you that Jesus says and does stuff in this passage that helps us to do that. That speaks to William Saroyan's now what, when you've got terminal cancer and told you've got 6 months or less to live. It speaks to people who are panicking about a pandemic. It speaks to you when, like Mary or Martha, you have just buried someone you dearly love. It speaks to people in the valley of the shadow of death. And this is Jesus, remember, from John chapter 10, already saying, I am the good shepherd, and he's riffing off Psalm 23, which is about people living in the valley of the shadow of death. This is how the good shepherd leads us through that. He's got to move towards death. The miserable, terrible predicament of it that we find ourselves in, that Lazarus has found himself in, that Mary and Martha are in, he's got to move towards death himself. He engages with it, so that you can face it. And the first thing we need, really, and it's on the outline there, is Jesus' perspective on death. I mean, maybe you found the stuff in verses 1 to 16 a little troubling, because he says and does some things that seem a bit hard and callous and careless, but he's showing us, I think, that death is not all that it seems. You know, John just introduces Lazarus, Mary and Martha, assuming that we know something about them. They are certainly familiar with Jesus. As verse 5 says, Jesus certainly loves them. And so when Lazarus gets sick, Mary and Martha just send word. Did you notice that? They don't even say, hey, please come and help. They just assume that Jesus will do the right thing. But notice what Jesus says as he gets word. This is Jesus' perspective on death. Verse 4, have a look. He says, this sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Death is not curtains. It is not the full stop to this story. In a strange way, death is going to serve God's purposes. It's actually going to show you what God is all about and what God does. Death is not outside of God's control. it's going to somehow turn people's eyes towards God and make much of him and make much of his son. And I think that's why Jesus still delays things. As a note, I think Lazarus probably dies as the messengers are on their way to Jesus, given how long it would take for Jesus to get to Bethany. But this is the thing. Look, he's not incompetent. He's not uncaring. He's deliberate, determined to glorify God and show how he's going to deal with death for Lazarus and for those he loves, and that includes us. And connected with that, another reason why he delays, death does another strange thing. It actually firms up our faith in him as his disciples. That's what comes out in the back and forth between Jesus and his disciples there in verses 7 to 16. You know, they're saying, oh, go back to Judea. The Jews were trying to stone you. That's where chapter 10 ends, doesn't it? And Jesus says in verse 9, no, look, it's daylight. He's saying it's safe to do this now. My hour hasn't come is kind of what I think he's getting at there. But the point is he just kind of cuts through his disciples' misunderstandings, doesn't he? Verse 14, Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I'm glad I was not there so that you may believe. He's not glad about Lazarus dying. The gladness will be about his disciples who already believe something in him, confronting death and actually having their faith in him firmed up. It's a growing moment for their faith. You know, who would have thought that death could serve a vaguely good purpose like that? But that's what it does. And that's probably what's going on for poor old Thomas there in verse 16. I think it's one of the really weird verses in the Bible. I'm never sure what to do with it. But I think he's starting to move in that direction. He goes, oh, let us go with it so that we might die with him. I think he's saying it's better to go and die with Jesus than be without him. And that's a growing faith thing. And I think he's probably saying more than he knows about what it means to go and die with Jesus and find life. But again, death isn't a full stop. It's not a dead end. It's not a doorway to nothing. It's not meaningless, purposeless, and pointless. It's part of the grace of God that death still actually serves his purposes. It's part of the grace of God that surprisingly death and dying can refine and firm up our faith, because it's pushing you to choose Jesus over being without him. And I think it's enough to say that that's a very different perspective on death and dying and suffering and hardship that our culture and our world around us often conditions us to, isn't it? You avoid it, you hide from it, you don't talk about it, it's meaningless. At best, it's just an escape from suffering. So, ironically, then we embrace it as soon as things get tough at the beginning and end of life. Jesus says, no, it's not a full stop to your story. I'm not really good with grammar, but I guess it's like a semicolon. And you better be ready for what comes next. So we need more here. I mean, for death to actually show God's glory and to firm up our faith, we need more than just Jesus' perspective. And that's where this passage goes next. We need Jesus to deal with death. And there's three things. We need his promises about life, about the future that actually help us now. And that comes out as he chats with Martha. By now, 4 days down track, the grieving culturally is in full swing. They are really letting loose now. The Jews believe that the spirit really leaves the body now. It's repulsed by the fact that, well, decomposition has really just started to set in. All hope is gone. That's when Jesus turns up. Verse 21, Martha is understandably disappointed. Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. And we feel that sometimes, don't we? You find yourself praying, asking for help, desperate prayers, and nothing. Now, Martha believes in Jesus, that he has power, that he can heal. I think she believes that he has power in the land of the living. In verse 22, it's her, I think, just kind of catching herself and trying to be calm and collected. But verse 39 is the tip-off, isn't it, that there's not a real conviction that Jesus can do something now. It's too late. But look at his promises. Verse 23, your brother will rise again. And her response is to parrot something that I think she's probably heard a lot. And maybe you've heard it too when you've lost someone. Oh, they'll rise again. There's a resurrection. That's again, the Jews believe that. There's a general last day resurrection. But general hope is just that, isn't it? It's general. What about me, Jesus? And future hope is just that. It's future. What about now? What's going to help me now? Well, here it's a personal present promise. It's solid because of the person who makes it. It's the next big I am statement in John's Gospel. Look at verse 25. I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. It is the promise that physical death will somehow be reversed by a resurrection, a physical one. And more than that, when we actually come to life, like Jesus talks to Nicodemus about back in chapter 3, you know, he talks about being born again, regenerated, spiritual life brought back. Nothing can touch that life. Not even death. Not the second death. Not God's judgment on sin. And we'll speak more about that in a moment. But life, the life of the age to come, is yours now and forever, through death into life. And I think that starts filling in more of the blanks about the purposes of death. I think it answers a question that often troubles us. I mean, it used to trouble me when I was a little kid. I believe in Jesus. Why am I still going to die? Well, a transformation needs to take place that Jesus is promising here. You know, we rightly say when somebody dies, oh, their suffering has ended. Yep, their physical suffering, particularly if it's been acute and painful, it ends. In one way, for the believer certainly, it's done. But more than that, for believers, it ends another kind of suffering. Death actually frees us from sinning. I think we were singing that in that hymn, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. The sin that kills you, you will, in a sense, die, and you'll never lust again, you'll never lie again, you'll never be jealous again, you'll never burn with anger again that spills over into all kinds of terrible stuff. You really begin living. I remember when my grandfather died, I was in my second year at Theological College in Sydney, and our principal, a guy called David Cook, had known my grandpa Doug years previous. I think he was maybe a bit sad that he died, because usually Cookie didn't talk to me. But anyway, the interesting thing he said to me was, his body's gone, but you need to know that your grandfather is more alive than ever right now. That's right. Yep, no more physical pain, but he's no longer sinning. And that's living. That's real life. Jesus is not promising us rest in peace or passing out into some blissed ethereal state. He's promising full-blown life that will one day then be reconnected with a resurrected body. And so, do you believe that? It's an awesome promise. It's not some vague, general, fluffy thing out there. He makes it this kind of personal, real thing that you can grab hold of now. It only works, the promise works because of the person. But we don't just get promises, we get more. How else can we face death? I mean, you also see here Jesus' compassion, don't you? As Mary comes to meet him, falls at his feet. Yeah, it's reverence. I reckon she's just crumpling. And the same disappointment in verse 32. Lord, if you'd been here, it's distressing. The Jews have followed her out of the house. Normally you would mourn in the house. And she does something unusual and gets up and heads towards the tomb and they go with her. And I think, like I was saying before, I mean, don't picture us reserved Westerners grieving, okay? You know, we sort of sit there and quietly cry and all that kind of gear. Think some kid has just got himself into trouble on the West Bank or the Gaza Strip, right? Got himself killed. The whole community comes out. They are screaming and beating their breasts. And Jesus looks at this kind of pitiful scene. In verse 33, what is he? He is deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Now deeply moved, you know, it's an unusual word in the Greek that's here. It's usually used with like a war horse snorting, like that. I did it in and not out because... Now I just wrecked the mood anyway. But it's usually used of people taking a sharp, angry breath. Because Jesus is angry. He's angry as. And you think, at what? A great Presbyterian theologian of the 19th century, Benjamin Warfield says, it's death. That's the object of his wrath. And behind death, him who has the power of death and whom he's come into the world to destroy. Remember, Jesus' eyes are God's eyes. He is looking at his creatures, harassed, hounded by sin and death, helpless before the grave. He's cheesed off. Theologians talk about this thing, the impassibility of God. They're saying he has no passions. And they mean that he has no passions exactly like us. And that is a good thing. He is stable and level. He doesn't melt down when we melt down. He's not thrown off by us. He's the unmoved mover. Aristotle actually kind of got it right. But as God takes on flesh in the person of Jesus, he has a human spirit that really feels. And right now, the wrath of God over sin and death is brimming in the person of Jesus. He is angry about what we do to ourselves and what sin does to us, because he loves us and he is compassionate. And he's saddened as well. I mean, you know, at the tomb, even before the stones rolled away, looking into the grave, seeing his loved one who is dead, Lazarus, verse 35, shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. And in the Greek, again, look, it's a different crying. It's a quiet tears rolling down the face of God. It's divine sympathy for Mary and for Martha. And I think he's expressing his own loss. Now, sometimes I think, you know, we're in Mary or Martha's shoes and people mean well, don't they? They say things to us and those things might even be true. And you just think, do you care though? Do you have a heart? I think it's remarkable here. Jesus knows exactly what he's going to do, yet he still cries, still weeps. And that God then that we sometimes wonder about, you know, does he care? This says, yeah, actually our sorrow and our tears and our suffering and our dying matters to God. And that's why this is here. There's nothing cold or detached or indifferent about God. This is a glimpse into his heart. So, folks, next time you say your last goodbye, the next time you're standing at the grave and you feel like the world is collapsing in around you and you feel like you're going to crumple and you feel like no one really gets you, Jesus does, because before you, he has stood at that place and he has surged with anger over what death is doing to you. And he's shed tears like you. And that's no cold comfort, I don't think. But we need more than compassion and tears. And that's what the Jews are saying in verse 37, isn't it? They're kind of like, oh, couldn't this guy who've opened the eyes of the blind done something? Better comfort? We need Jesus' power. It's the third thing, isn't it, to defeat death. Verse 38, have a look at it. He's deeply moved again. It's the same verb. This time the war horse is snorting because he's about to charge and mow down his enemy. Death and hell should be really worried. Nothing's going to stop him. Not 4 days dead, not a bad odour. Not even the wavering doubt and uncertainty of his creatures around him. He says, doesn't he, in verse 40, didn't I tell you? You would see God's glory, that death would be this strange place where you will go, wow, God is amazing. This is what God does. There's no magic mutterings of a wizard. There's no smoke and mirrors. Verse 41, he simply prays out loud, doesn't he, for the benefit of those standing around so that they may believe that he's been sent by the Father and that this is God's power at work. And then he commands the shout, Lazarus, come out, in verse 43. There's something here about him assuming that Lazarus will actually hear. Because like he said earlier, this sickness won't end in death. Yeah, his body's dead. You imagine the scene, don't you? You know, imagine the smell maybe, if you've ever been in a place like that. There's this crowd peering into the tomb. He was probably mummified like an Egyptian. You know, he breathed his last 4 days ago. And all of a sudden, he takes a breath in and stirs and sits up. And the brain starts firing and the heart starts pumping, and he shifts off this shelf that they've put him on, stands up, rocks a bit, I'd imagine, and kind of waddles to the mouth of the grave, out of the jaws of death. People's tears stopping maybe, or changing from tears of grief to tears of joy. Out of death comes life, out of the grave. That's the glory of God. That's the way death strangely provokes faith in Jesus. Now, this is the last big sign that Jesus does before the sign. Now, this is a foretaste of what's coming. A foretaste, isn't it, of things like every tear being wiped away? It's a foretaste, though, because it's incomplete. Lazarus will die again. And in the Gospels, it strikes me that Jesus is really reticent to raise people from the dead. I think Jairus' daughter, there's a widow, and Lazarus. And that's because they're being raised back into a body that gets coronavirus, right? A body that gets worse than that. This is not the entirety of what Jesus has come to do. There's another sign, another display of power, so that the words of that crowd there in verse 37, couldn't he have kept people from dying, will actually be true, but forever. And you see, not long from now in John's Gospel, death will come again to be the strange place where God's glory is seen and people will believe. There's a time where Jesus, God in the flesh, won't just get angry about sin and its effects. There's going to be the hour where Jesus will bear in himself the anger, the full vented holy anger of God about sin. So it's done with. So that you won't die bearing that anger forever, so that death will actually lead to life. It's a cliched, well-known story, but that's all I've got at the moment. Donald Gray Barnhouse, the great preacher of last century, minister of the 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, he lost his wife to cancer when they were in their 30s, and so he's like left with four small kids. And after the funeral, he's driving home with them and they are inconsolable. They are losing it because they've lost their mum. And Barnhouse talks about how later he was trying to work out a way to comfort them, struggling for a way. And just then, as they're sitting in the car, this big truck drives past them and the shadow of the truck swept over their car. And I don't know if I would have thought of saying this, but he turns to his kids and he says, "Would you rather be run over by the truck or by its shadow?" And the children say, "Oh, the shadow, Dad, because that can't hurt us." And then he says to them, "Well, 2,000 years ago, the truck of death ran over the Lord Jesus in order that only its shadow might run over us." That's the thing. I mean, death is real, but it's only a shadow of its former self after the cross. It's formidable and it's fearful, but it actually cannot hurt you eternally. It's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians that Josh read earlier, 15. You know, it's had its sting taken out. It's not the winner here. Jesus bears the full power of sin and death, its eternal condemning power, so that we don't. And he rises from the grave forever so that we know that the promises are true, that I am the resurrection and the life isn't some sort of partial thing. I don't just get raised again like Lazarus is here to die again and to suffer more. That's the power of Jesus' death confronting death for us, and that's the power we need. It's a power that speaks loudly as him shouting, "Lazarus, come out," to you in a pandemic, to you in those moments where the separation from a loved one hurts deeply. It speaks loud and clear when your time comes, when you're like William Savoyan saying, "Everyone has to die, but I thought an exception would be made in my case. Now what?" There's no exception, but there's actually something better. You don't just hang around in this body forever. That would be miserable. You have got a much, much, much better destination ahead of you. So, folks, Benjamin Franklin got it wrong. There's two things you can be certain of, death and taxes. But this passage is saying there's a third thing you can be certain of, and that's life. So minimise your tax, go to the gym, go on the diet, please wash your hands, but trust Jesus' promises and find real comfort in knowing that he cares for you more than you know, that he has been deeply moved about your helpless and hopeless state, and find even greater comfort in knowing that he's done something about it.